president of the International Olympic Committee, announced that the Olympics will be shut down after this year's competition. Try to administer a fair competition between cloned athletes, transgender and intersex athletes, those who have undergone transplant surgery to improve performance, and athletes with varying degrees of bionic components has made running an impartial contest a nightmare, lowered Holovision ratings, and made securing corporate sponsors almost impossible. Transplants, cloning, and biogenetic engineering won't just change the dynamics of sporting competitions. They'll revolutionize medical care, longevity, and retirement, affecting a variety of things from what it means to be human to the business of agriculture and insurance, just to name a few. Take retirement, for instance. For years, financial planners have advised their clients to save a small percentage of their income and invest it, right? But that was when people lived 7 or 10 years after they retired. Now people are living 30 years after retirement. When that number moves to 50 or 200 or never, it will require serious rethinking. The longer your time frame is after you stop earning, the greater the danger that inflation will threaten your financial security. Of course, eventually the age at which we retire will be adjusted up dramatically. But for the transition generation or two, there will be previously unseen and serious threats to their financial security and some delicious opportunities for entrepreneurs. There's a growing movement of people who have built their own electronic brain stimulation machines. An Atlanta physician named James Fugity is one of the leaders of the movement, and most of the adherents have the technological savvy to build their own machines. They all report enhanced memory and concentration. Self-taught biogerontologist Audrey DeGray created a controversy when he suggested that the first human beings who will live to 1,000 years old have already been born. DeGray makes the case that aging is simply another disease that will be cured. The approach DeGray uses is to treat aging as an engineering problem, identifying all the components that cause human tissue to age, and then designing remedies for each of them. He's dubbed this process Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, S-E-N-S. Before you discount DeGray as a kook, you should know he's been published in many really respected journals, including medical journals. And while many have challenged his assertions, no one has been able to convincingly dispute them. You probably saw Transcendence, that 2014 sci-fi thriller starring Johnny Depp. But how futuristic is that movie really? Ray Kurzweil predicts that we'll be uploading our entire minds to computers by 2045, and machines will replace our fragile bodies within 90 years. Oh, and by the way, that would pretty much make you immortal. What we're witnessing here is the movement of genetic engineering from the medical world to the personal healthcare market. This will be similar in scope to what happened when computers moved from business to personal and the internet went from educational institutions to virtually everybody. This metamorphosis created untold numbers of millionaires and billionaires, yet that pales in comparison to what happens when genetics make that jump. August 13th, 2024. Danny, I just got your progress update and you're failing your 9-month online certification. It's no big deal, Mom. I'm sure I'll improve before the final certifications are issued. It is a big deal. If you don't pass this, you're going to have to go to college and get an MBA degree. If you have to settle for a college degree, you'll never get a good job. You'll make a lot less money for the rest of your life. This may be the most critical we have to deal with, relearning how to learn. If we actually were able to jump into that DeLorean DMC-12, or perhaps that hot tub time machine, travel back to the 18th century and bring back Immanuel Kant, Thomas Jefferson, or Adam Smith, there is one thing they would immediately recognize, and that's the education system. 3 centuries later, we're still following the same educational model they used back then, one that was designed to train people to work in factories or on farms. There are flickers of innovation here or there. For example, I'm going to give special bonus points to the Management Information Systems Department of Temple University Fox School of Business and Management, which has in essence brought gamification to college. The school's implemented a point system where students need to achieve a certain amount of professional development points before they graduate. They promote this with a leaderboard that showcases the students with the most points and by issuing professional achievement badges for the students. Other than these kind of flickers of creativity and the movement toward online learning, education is still stuck in thinking that's 3 centuries old. Is it any wonder that so many executives who were trained in our business schools exhibit such derivative, corporate, and herd mentality thinking today? Simply making the leap from training knowledge workers instead of factory workers would be huge, but that's still not enough. We get to rethink the role and the value of acquiring knowledge. Of all the industries and professions we've discussed thus far, perhaps none will face such cataclysmic change and be open to more opportunities than education. Think about the people in charge of helping us think. Online dating, virtual reality companions, and virtual reality sex situations, and likely clone sex workers, will completely perplex millions of people with issues relating to intimacy, social interaction, relationships, and addiction. This will present huge new growth opportunities for teachers, professors, relationship therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health counselors, addiction specialists, and the entire mental health field to develop and grow. But it won't happen at the current level of thinking. A majority of corporate and thought leaders will be the product of learning and education programs outside of traditional universities. This seemingly infinite warehouse of knowledge stored electronically will disrupt education in momentous ways. Will the time really come when a college degree is a fallback option for people who couldn't cut it in some kind of specific online vocational certification? Will we reach a point when a 6 or 9 month certification in some area from some entity will be infinitely more valuable than an MBA or PhD? These questions will require thinking bigger than debating campus versus online learning or traditional university versus the MOOCs, the massive open online courses. The discussion needs to focus instead on issues such as the definition of learning, how we learn, and what learning is actually useful and necessary. Information wants to be free, but the cost of education is headed in the opposite direction. Here in the United States, the federal government has increased the money it's spending on grants, loans, and tuition tax breaks. Yet the Wall Street Journal reports that the average cost of in-state tuition and room and board at a public university has increased 40% faster than economy-wide inflation over the last decade. While private school tuition and related costs have not gone up as rapidly, they too have outpaced inflation. And of course, they were much pricier to begin with. The amount of debt required for most people to get a college education today is obscene. The marketability of a degree wanes, the cost continues to rise, and its actual viability and value in the employment market is diminishing. So, like healthcare, entertainment, and other industries, higher learning today is infected with a centuries-old culture that blocks technology and other developments that would improve productivity and effectiveness. Right now, companies are at the mercy of selecting graduates from business schools that are stuck in outdated learning models. Savvy employers will have to take a more proactive approach in training and education, and savvy employees will have to take more personal responsibility for their own learning. Of course, there's another less talked about but critical area to consider. That is the emotional and philosophical maturation process that can take place while attending university. So I was speaking about this with Nito Cabane, a great friend of mine who is the president of High Point University. And he drove home the point. Well, here's what he told me. One reality will always exist. Innovation at every corner is a must. But also acknowledging that 18-year-olds go to college residentially for an extended period of time, also to grow emotionally and mature intellectually. You can't access that through the MOOCs. As far as the future of higher education, here's what he predicts. Many colleges will sadly suffer. Some will be enhanced in measurable ways. Along the way, everybody in education must be committed to rethink and recreate how knowledge and wisdom are taught, learned. I do not see a doomsday scenario. I do see a major redo. Now, Nito has an optimistic view on the future of education, but most learning institutions are in the nonprofit or government sector, areas that I think have been traditionally years and years behind the private sector in development. So not only will these institutions have to catch up with the level of thinking in the entrepreneurial world, but they will need to stay abreast of the level of thinking needed to jump to in the next decade. This will require an exponential leap. If I were running Google, or if I were running Apple right now, the first thing I would do is I would set aside about $50 million and start my own high school and university. And then I would begin offering housing, internships, and scholarships to the most talented and promising teens around the world. I wouldn't wait for the education system to catch up with programs needed to prepare our workforce for success. I would create them. By coming at the situation absent the preconceived memes of the current education model, you could truly create the ideal one. January 7th, 2026. Coming up on 60 Minutes, we look back at one of the most popular business books of the last decade, Mad Genius. When it was first published in 2016, it created quite a stir because of its bold predictions for the decade. Tonight, we'll show how far off author Randy Gage was and try to figure out how he could have been so wrong. Okay, let's be honest. It won't be 60 minutes doing a show like that. But you can be sure 10 years from now, some media outlet will be licking its chops for the chance to post snarky comments on what I got wrong in this book. I can handle that. And here's the reason I can handle it. Because I'm supposed to be wrong. So are you. If you want to win, you have to be willing to fail. You won't get everything right. No one does. Every one of these areas is certainly off limits for discussion at the place you work right now, very likely. That's how we know these are the places where the real money will be made. The entrepreneurs who have the guts to think differently, blow up the box, and tap their mad genius have the best odds for success. Whether you're in any of the businesses mentioned so far, or thousands of others I haven't named, you and your business are not prepared for this future. That's because no one is prepared for all this. Perhaps some of what I've written and you've listened to now has made you mad, sad, or scared. I hope so, because if not, I haven't done my job. My goal is not to leave you in that state of mad or sad or scared, but to wake you up to the challenges coming and help you prepare for the new and higher level of thinking we must practice. The kind of thinking that will empower, liberate, and energize you. Because once you understand the choices you'll be facing and realize the power you have in those choices, the more powerful those choices will become. The entrepreneurs and companies who help people cope with the cataclysmic changes we're about to face will become the wealthiest on the planet. And probably a few other planets. But let's dig deeper. I hesitated to use the phrase cope with in the last paragraph because it implies that all changes are hurtful and negative. Coping usually means dealing with something beyond your control, something being done to you. That's a fundamental problem today. We're all being done to by politicians and educators and governments. Coping is a reactive approach to managing problems, and it's all about looking backwards and not being on the level of thinking that will move us toward where we really want to go. The reality is that many of the changes we're about to experience will be cathartic, liberating, and transformative. The greatest future lies in wait for those who create and ignite this revolution, evolution, in the first place. But that's going to require a very different mindset from what they're teaching in most MBA programs. You don't need a new mission statement, another trust fall workshop, or a consultant telling you to delight and amaze your customers. You won't do it reading more books about how Starbucks, Zappos, Southwest Airlines, or Nordstrom did it either. You do it by tapping into your mad genius as an artist and entrepreneur. You do it when you commit to thinking differently. You can't just think out of the box, out of this world, or even out of the universe. You've got to think in ways no human being has ever thought before. You've got to create art. Not just any art. You've got to create art that is thermo-fucking-nuclear. Book 3, The Age of the Entrepreneur. Why does Grandma cut the ends off the ham before she puts it in the oven? If you had a dime for every motivational speaker giving book reports on the latest hardcover from Jack Welch, Tom Peters, or Jim Collins, you could buy half of Dubai. But you really don't need another bestseller summary, do you? Likewise, for all the consultants and speakers who give those speeches about getting out of the box, Roger Bannister in the 4-Minute Mile, or why Grandma cut the ends off the ham, turkey, roast beef before she put it in the oven. And do you really need to hear the starfish story again? Unfortunately, the speakers and consultants sharing those lessons have fallen prey to the very thing they're preaching against, habitual thinking. And nothing does more to dumb you down, hold you back, and prevent you from creative thinking than getting mired in a stale thought pattern. It's the ultimate limiting belief because it precludes most possibility thinking. The smarter you are, the greater the likelihood you are intellectually lazy. Don't be. Nurturing your mad genius. What's the secret to getting in front of trends, seeing around the corner, and being the first mover in lucrative new markets? How can you unleash the awesome brilliance you have inside, waiting to bubble over? Just how do you tap into your innate mad genius to create breakthrough marketing, innovate new products, or develop fresh concepts? Well, let's start with the bad news first. If you're the bottom line, action-oriented, results type in those personality profile tests, and you know who you are if you are, you're in for a disappointment. I don't have an exact top-secret, patent-pending, 7-step process for developing mad genius to sell you. And to be honest, if I did, I certainly wouldn't sell it to you for the special one-time-only introductory offer operators are standing by now, ridiculously low price of this manifesto. But know this. The path to thermo-fucking-nuclear is not a linear one. The process, even the environment for developing breakthrough products, disrupting markets, and creating brilliant concepts is often a wild, circuitous one. Sometimes it means bouncing off the walls like a pinball. Other times it means finding inspiration in the shower, playing the what-if game, discovering the 999 ways it doesn't work, and sometimes, amazingly enough, when you're actually trying to come up with an idea for something. Many of you listening to me right now have a team you want to inspire and empower to embrace creative possibility thinking. Others of you are solopreneurs looking for the one thing that will bust you through to success. In either case, mad genius begins with you. And yes, you really do possess mad genius. Everybody does. It simply manifests itself differently depending on your environment, experiences, and how you nurture it or don't. What I'm about to share with you is everything I know about unleashing mad genius. I'll try to be as concise as possible. You're busy, I'm busy, and we both know that the more time you spend listening to me talking about how to tap into your creative brilliance translates into less time you're actually being creatively brilliant. I'll be positive and encouraging because I love the subject and the creative high that comes with helping people create art and become amazing. But no, while I believe everyone has the gift of genius, it isn't something you find. It's a process you commit to. You're going to have to do the work. And achieving any breakthrough starts with a decision. So, if you've decided you want to be one of the cool kids, allow me to share some insights on what it takes to become a critical thinker and see the world and its possibilities in bold and breathtaking new ways. First, you have to be doing work that matters to you. Doesn't have to be important to everyone, but it better be important to you. Nothing dumbs down and dampens creativity like wasting it in the pursuit of mediocrity. Attempt epic things that are so intoxicating they pull you toward them. It may or may not be work that changes the world, but it better change your state. It should bring you joy, ignite your passion, or bring you harmony. I had the honor of having dinner with one of my heroes, legendary tenor Plácido Domingo. Of course, he's one of the greatest artists of all time, a brilliant conductor, worldwide icon, and at least a dozen Grammys that I know of. But there's one thing about him that I find the most fascinating. The world-class opera singers, people at Domingo's level, they're known for a few signature roles. They find the ones that best match their language, their style, and their vocal range. Then they spend the rest of their career making their circuit of the various opera houses around the world, stick into those three or four roles that they've become famous for. Domingo doesn't perform four. He performs 134. This is simply unheard of for somebody operating at his level. So I had to ask him, what drove him to do that? Does he get bored with being safe? Does he do it because he seeks the challenge? His answer was surprising. It has nothing to do with challenge, he told me, in a voice which, of course, is as lyrical speaking as it is singing. He said, I have passion for the music, and even if I lived three lifetimes, I could never perform all of the music I love. When you have the same joyfulness to bring your product to market, launch your new venture, or create the next breakthrough concept, you'll power your own creativity. The problem with problem solving. When dealing with any challenge or setback, consider your frame of reference and the context of the discussion. Often the premise is misstated, and like I said earlier, if the premise is wrong, everything that comes from that premise is wrong. If you charge your team with solving a problem, you shouldn't be surprised to discover later that they've been looking backwards. That's because problem solving in and of itself is inherently backward looking. For real breakthroughs, you have to stop living in the problem and live in the solution instead. The same holds true if you're instructing your team to solve a puzzle. Jigsaw puzzles work because all the pieces are in the box when you buy them. All you have to do is figure out where to put each piece. However, as we talked about in book two, all the necessary pieces for the challenges you and your business are about to face aren't even in the box. So if we're going to use the puzzle analogy here, we have to modify the parameters. Now your job is to use all the puzzle pieces that came in the box, see where they fit, then fill in the remaining space by creating some new pieces in that 3D printer called your brain. When you empower your team to create a possibility, a whole different forward-looking perspective is created. What we're really talking about is your ability to see the intangible. Let me give you a real-world example how this plays out in the entrepreneurial space. I was approached by Linneus, a tech startup, to serve on their advisory board. One of their existing board members had read my book, Risky is the New Safe, and suggested they bring me on board because I knew where tech and video were headed. I spent a day floundering around their website and still had no idea, no clue what they actually did. So I emailed a few of my really smart colleagues in an internet mastermind group I belonged to, asking for their take. They all came back with similar bewilderment. These colleagues, they're really bright people, all successful entrepreneurs who harness the internet and have built huge businesses on it. They didn't see any marketable value in the technology Linneus was offering either. But this feeling just kept gnawing at me. I felt like something was there if only I could quantify it in a way I could wrap my mind around. I'm no techie by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know how to write code. I'm not a programmer, and I have a hard enough time recording two programs simultaneously on my DVR. My gift is not in understanding what makes technology work, but how humans use technology, and more importantly, how that technology can solve problems and create possibilities. Because when you know how to solve problems, then you know how to create wealth. And when you know how to see and act on possibilities, then you know how to create disproportionate wealth. Entrepreneurs with the ability to solve problems get rich. entrepreneurs with the ability to envision as yet unseen possibilities get really, really rich. The iPad didn't solve a problem, and no one really was asking for it. Steve Jobs envisioned a possibility for something that, once people were exposed to it, they simply had to have it. So I kept exploring what it was that Linnaeus did and pondering why anybody else would care. It took me a couple of days longer to understand that Finbar O'Hanlon, who's the founder, what he had actually done was create a language for video known as VQL, for Video Query Language. Which, of course, Finbar already knew, but he couldn't explain to me due to the language difference. I speak English, and he speaks tech. But now, I had a concept my high school dropout mind could actually process. Larry Ellison created a language for data, and that made Oracle worth about $37 billion, give or take a few billion. So that led me to believe that a language for video might have some intrinsic value in the marketplace. When video is turned into a language, transcoding is no longer necessary. A video query language would mean any business in the world could use the data they or other companies possess to dynamically build content. Data at every frame can be disassembled, reassembled, and reordered in seconds without any processing. That language could allow, for instance, Google to apply their AdSense program to their YouTube channel with ferocious velocity. Or networks like Fox, CNN, and the BBC could unlock the value in their content by extracting specific frames of audio and video out of a single file, then publish this extract as part of a new show without having to go to an edit suite. Because I began to see potential uses for the technology, I went back to my brilliant internet mastermind partners. But now, when I presented the question, I was doing so in a context that some of them could immediately grasp. They suggested even more uses for the technology. The promise of this kind of system would mean revolutionizing how we watch video. For example, suppose you have a video that shows a number of different pets, but you wanted to view clips only featuring dogs. Instead of having to cut and edit a very long video into a new video montage of the dog segments, you could use the indexing system to simply select and play those segments, creating a new video on the fly. Going to extremes, a NASCAR fan in Nashville could set his feed to only follow the 24 car rather than all the drivers. Or as another example, a network, which could be broadcast or otherwise, doesn't matter, could stream one feed of a movie or program around the globe, but still offer different versions. The NC-17 rated one to a single guy in New York with the latest NTSC smart TV, somebody in Auckland watching in PAL format, and a family in Abu Dhabi watching the version with adult content filtered out. All from the same stream. The reception device would determine what data to pick from the stream and display. The control could be at the user's end, or more likely at the service provider's end, with the ability to exercise that control for an additional fee. The potential for disruption is staggering in fields from sports to news, entertainment to law enforcement, encryption to even national security. The true value of the concept, and all the others we'll look at in this book, of course, will be determined by the market. Like any startup, Linnaeus could go big or go bust, and the eventual outcome will have to be played out in the actual marketplace. As is the case with most new ventures, success then becomes about the strength of the patents, adequate financing, a talented startup team, and lots of other variables. But the real lesson here that I want to get across to you is your ability to see possibilities. The reality of miracles. It doesn't take much insight to know there's money to be made selling lemonade in the desert. Mad genius is the ability to think creatively and see opportunities that aren't so obvious. That's where the greatest opportunities lie in wait. Verdant Technologies, LLC, in Scottsdale, Arizona, is conducting research on how changing the frequency of liquids and solids can enable them to do things they couldn't normally do. This actually changes the molecular structure of the target material, which, of course, changes then the results you get. In their tests so far, they are producing 40% higher crop yields in fields and greenhouses by changing the frequency of water. Other experiments have shown a 15% stronger concrete, batteries that recharge faster and last longer, and magnets that are strengthened by more than 30%. This company faces skepticism because to many, this kind of transformation sounds like a miracle. Of course, in a way it is, because all physics is a miracle. What new realities, and let's put possibilities in parentheses, do you want? Ian Percy is an organizational psychologist with a business card that identifies him as a possibility coach. Okay, does anyone actually have business cards anymore? I don't know, but that's his job title. He brought several tech geniuses together in a startup called Emendara LLC that is focused not on one, but two impossibilities. First, they claim to possess technology capable of locating all faults and errors in software. The number of people in the world who currently believe in even the possibility of fault-free software can probably be counted on one hand. Second, two members of the group patented a new massively parallel processor, which is a superchip that can process a breathtaking 65,536 bits per cycle. Currently, a typical chip in your computer processes 128 bits per cycle. So forget Moore's Law. This is a leap in several levels of magnitude and processing power, and the implications are staggering. Put both these impossibilities together, and it's estimated that they'll be able to find all faults in 30 million lines of software code in fewer than 10 minutes. But when Ian Percy presents this concept to seasoned, high-level technocrats, he's been often just greeted with utter disbelief, and they just waving him away without even talking to him. And this still happens, even though the existence of this superchip, now called the Automata processor, has been announced by Micron Technologies and will probably already be released by the time you're hearing my voice. So here's the real takeaway. Many of these possibilities emerging now, and others that will emerge, are such exponential advancements that many people, even highly educated ones, can't understand them. And because they can't understand them, they initially discount their validity. Most of us have been conditioned to linear, incremental advancements. Now we're moving into an age of exponential innovations, and many people are simply not mentally prepared to deal with these huge leaps. And the best example of this, I think, is demonstrated by the rash of recent TED videos. And from this, I mean the real TED conference videos, not the one I made up earlier. in which teenagers are coming up with incredible technical and biological discoveries that are shaking up the established scientific community. 17-year-old Angela Zhang produced research that might lead to a potential cure for cancer. Teenager Jack Andreka developed an early detection system for pancreatic cancer that is 28 times faster than the current tests. Samantha Garvey, who was homeless at the time, was recognized for her discoveries in marine biology. High school senior Eric Chen was awarded a scholarship for his work that might prevent flu outbreaks. Like a lot of geniuses, they are too naive to know why something won't work. Are you? Moving from behind to beyond. Regardless of what happens with any of these ventures I've talked about in this book, they all illustrate the complexity of the issues we will be facing and the type of thinking they will require. Problem solving, by its very nature, is reactive. We're going to need to move away from that thought process and move toward being able to recognize the opportunities inherent in challenges. The possibility thinking model is really the only way forward, so that we can synergistically coexist with the machines and continue our onward and upward evolution. Simply solving problems is a mindset geared to the past. Creating possibilities is a mindset to the future. Creating that future. I'm not sure there were ever any set rules for entrepreneurs and leaders, but if there were, they're all out the window now, because we are entering the decade of chaos. And chaos isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes it's downright delicious. In evolutionary processes, such as many that we're talking about in this book, order, which is the opposite of chaos, is actually increasing. But the catalyst for this order was initially chaos. That's because order itself is a natural state baked in the cake by Mother Nature. From the ultimate chaos of the Big Bang, gases cooled, planets emerged, gravity developed, solar systems coalesced, creatures crawled from the swamps, apes began to walk upright, and eventually you too recorded "Where the Streets Have No Name." Chaos creates order, and order then builds on itself, which will eventually lead to a seminal milestone. Technology creating its own next generation without any intervention from us, the species that created it. Some of what we're talking about, we could best describe it using a term my friend Ian Percy, who we just talked about, a term he uses, chaotic, which is a label for this delicate dance between order and chaos. In fact, if you think about some of the case studies we've talked about in this book, there's nothing chaotic about them other than they defy conventional expectations of order. In reality, they ultimately bring order to things. The evolution or revolution of technological advancement is accelerating exponentially because it builds on its own increasing order. Developing your own creative genius often follows a similar process. Some creativity is adaptive, modifying or altering what already exists in new ways. Other creativity is innovative, introducing something entirely new that never existed before. Either one can make you wealthy, and either one can change the world. Whole brain synchronicity. One of the first things you can do to develop your own mad genius is to stop classifying your brain into left, right, or logical creative sides. Likewise, stop categorizing yourself in one group or the other. These beliefs about two different sides of brain function came from research done with accident or stroke victims who had lost parts of their brain. If you've read this far, you're still accessing enough from both sides of your brain to be brilliant. The optimal state for you is what scientists call whole brain synchronicity, in which you have thoughts going back and forth, creating neural pathways between the right and left hemispheres of your brain. This synchronicity between two halves of the brain dramatically improves your creative powers, not to mention your learning ability, memory, and intuition. It's believed that this increased communication between the two hemispheres is what really separates geniuses like Einstein, Edison, and Mozart from the average person. Once you pry open the rusty gate between the two halves of your brain, you start to experience increased mental clarity, greater creativity, and improved learning ability. The creativity triad. Three things are necessary to foster creative genius: experience, some form of a capturing system, and taking action. Let's look at each of those. The experiences you go through provide the stimulation that jumpstarts your creativity. That's why most people aren't creative. They do the same thing day after day. They work in the same dead-end job for years, eat in the same restaurants, ordering the same entree, and vacation at the same place every year. They have a standardized, limited spectrum of experiences. Creative people travel, learn new languages, study other cultures, and meet many different people. Their lives are a kaleidoscope of many interesting and different experiences. And because each day offers new experiences, neural pathways don't grind ruts in their brain. They aren't so susceptible to habitual thinking and are much more likely to achieve a self-actualized state. The other thing that creative people do is capture their experiences and internalize them. That's why so many creative people are speakers, writers, musicians, actors, and of course, entrepreneurs. Actors like Al Pacino, Meryl Streep, and Denzel Washington lose themselves in a role. They're subconsciously capturing the emotion of the situation they're acting out. Only they aren't acting anymore, they are living in that role. A creative writing genius like Hemingway captured the ethos, emotion, and physical context of the situations he wrote about. He put himself into that situation and then brought us along for the ride. It's probably not a coincidence that many of the most brilliant entrepreneurs I know, who are loaded down with smartphones, tablets, smartwatches, and laptops, still have a paper journal they physically write in. Journaling can really stoke your creative muse. It does so because it keeps you alone with your thoughts. This type of mental seclusion and introspection is always good for creation. In my office, I actually have two desks. I have a regular, looks like normal desk with laptop, monitor, all of that stuff on it. And then I have another one, which is a drafting table, with nothing but poster boards, sketch pads, colored pencils, and markers. The best way to capture concepts, however, is to create them. That's where the third part, taking action, comes in. Imagination by itself is not creativity. Creativity requires that you actually do something with whatever you're daydreaming about. Start that company, launch that new product, develop that innovative app. Not everything that you try will work, but that's not the point. The point is that you're in the game, doing things, moving forward. You'll learn as much or more from your failures as you will from your success. Celebrate it all. Newtonian physics has taken you as far as it can. The economy is now rewarding art and innovation and guts. Brilliant ideas executed with singular direction by aligned teams on behalf of truly motivated customers. Take the intellectual risks and do the emotional labor you're capable of. Seth Godin. Fighting the disease of big. If you remember in the Great Recession of 2008, there was a lot of talk about the big banks and investment houses being too big to fail. That's debatable, of course, but there's no debate that banks offer way too many examples of something every successful entrepreneur must guard against, being too big to excel. And this is what happens when organizations reach success and add too many layers, doctrines, and bureaucracy. Much like book publishers who seem determined to make themselves irrelevant, banking is another industry that just, they seem oblivious to the threats that they're facing. Too big can quickly turn into irrelevant. Let me share a case study of exactly how the banking industry works, as it contains numerous lessons on how organizations get so big that they can no longer respond and stay competitive in the marketplace. I did a sabbatical a couple years ago. I was traveling the world and thought it might be cool to just pick somewhere on a map and move there. And I had always enjoyed San Diego when I visited there. So I decided to relocate there if the right place became available. So I contacted my banker at Wells Fargo, and I told him I wanted to get pre-approved for a mortgage. So if I found something I liked, I could close immediately. I gave him the amount I wanted to be pre-approved for, submitted all the documents they requested, and a month later got an approval, which should have been the first alarm because a month is a ridiculous time to wait in today's market. Anyway, I engaged a real estate broker in San Diego, and I found a building I liked a lot, but there were no units on a high floor with the view that I wanted. A few months later, when I was living in Australia still, a unit that was meeting my criteria became available on really short notice. The San Diego market was hot. I wanted to close fast, because at this point, I mean, units went into whisper listings, and they were sold in days. But Wells Fargo was still living in the real estate bubble meltdown days. For 6 weeks, I tried to close every day. For 6 weeks, every day they asked for another document, another letter, or something. Remember, I was supposed to already be pre-approved. So what was the issue? There was a lawsuit between the homeowners association and the developer. Not an unusual occurrence today. In fact, it's pretty common. I knew of the lawsuit when I made the offer, and I had no problem with it. The developer was actually cooperating with the homeowners association to reach a settlement with the insurance company. But because this litigation existed, whoever was allegedly empowered to make decisions couldn't tick that box on the checklist. So for 6 weeks, they sent a steady stream of requests for more information with no end in sight. I finally gave up in exasperation. I sold some of my precious metals, and I paid cash for the apartments. Banks, or really any business, can't get away with operating that way in today's market if they want to stay relevant. But we're just getting started on this little case study. I decided Wells Fargo, they were just simply too bureaucratic in nature to be a viable bank for somebody like me who's an entrepreneur. So I was going to close my accounts. So just when I was about to do that, I found out they were the major